You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening. My name is Ila Javeri, and I'm president of the Council of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. It is my great pleasure to welcome you all to this remarkable evening being co-produced by the Council and the Library Foundation's Aloud program. Viet Thanh Nguyen and Leila Lalami are friends of the Library Foundation, and the amazing number of registrations we have had for this evening is evidence of our affection for them and their work. I value my special connection with Viet, as he was our guest author at our home for the Council's biennial fundraiser, the Literary Feast. He had everybody around our table enthralled with the discussion of its Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sympathizer. What I have to say is that we are so fortunate today that we are all in our homes and around our own table to experience him talk to us about the sequel book in which he takes his characters to the next level, The Committed. We are very grateful to Viet for giving the time to us in his very busy schedule to be with us this evening. He holds an endowed position as professor of English and American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. And he also has fellowships from the Guggenheim and the MacArthur Foundations, an author of nonfiction, of short stories, and an editor of an anthology on refugee writing, and the winner of the 2016 Pulitzer Prize in Fiction and 7 other awards. When we asked Viet who he would like to interview him today, there was not a pause. He immediately said, Leila Lalami. And happily, we're so glad that Leila is available this evening. And we are very thankful and grateful to her as well for in her busy schedule to make the time for us this evening. Leila is the author of 4 novels and the winner of the American Book Award and a finalist in the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, and also the recipient of many awards and honors. Her recent novel, The Other Americans, was a national bestseller and a finalist for the Kirkus Prize and also for the National Book Award in Fiction. We could not have imagined a better partner this evening to have to discuss with Viet. We are very honored to have the two of you with us this evening, and everyone is so looking forward to this conversation. Welcome, Viet Thanh Nguyen, and welcome, Leila Lalami.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Ila. It's always such a pleasure to see you, and really thanks for all your support for the library. Hi, Leila.
Hi, Viet. Good evening, everybody. My name is Leila Lalami, and it is my distinct pleasure to be in conversation with Viet Thanh Nguyen about his new novel, The Committed. We'll be talking for about 35 minutes, and then we will open it up for your questions. At any time during the program, you can type your question into the question box, and one of the moderators will select a few for Viet to answer. And of course, please support this program and the author by ordering his book from your favorite independent bookstore. So Viet, how are you? I think you were telling me when we were in the green room that this is your 3rd event for the day.
Yeah, I've been everywhere all over the country today. Never left Pasadena from this chair. So that's our new reality. It's a pleasure to be here talking with you. You know, I always think of you as one of my best interlocutors because we share the same concerns.
How sweet of you. Are you almost done with your tour for The Committed?
I don't think so. So I sort of lost time. You know, it's so many things are happening. I'm also teaching at the same time, by the way, and that's its own level of weirdness. Trying to teach 100 undergraduates purely through Zoom. So
I know it's a little strange. Were you teaching today?
Yes, I taught too. So I did the 3 events and I taught in the middle of it. But I'm still fresh for you.
That's good. I taught too. I did a seminar on waiting for the barbarian. So I feel like all warmed up. I'm ready. I'm ready to talk. All right. So since this is a library event, I thought I would start by asking you about your earliest exposure to books. So I had the great good fortune of growing up in a house full of them. And although my parents didn't go to college, they both loved reading. And so it was very natural to me from a very young age to just be reading, have a book in my hands and be reading. And it just felt very ordinary. In fact, I don't remember a time when I wasn't a reader. And that I feel was a great fortune in my life. So I want to hear about your experience. When did you start reading? What kind of books did you read? What kind of literature?
I'm so envious of you because I grew up in a household with one bookshelf and no books. I mean, there was a bookshelf and there were no books on the bookshelf. You know, I mean, my parents were very hardworking people, but I don't think literature was just on their horizon at all. And, you know, the thing I never figured out is they're also devoutly Catholic, but we didn't even have a Bible in the house. So there wasn't even that much. So I turned to the library for books. And from very, very early on, after coming to the United States as a refugee at 4 years of age, some of my earliest memories are from a public library. And I don't even remember how I learned how to read English or speak English because my parents didn't teach me. I learned that in school somehow, but I became fluent very fast. And so by the time I was 5 or 6, I was borrowing books from the library. And that became my second home because my parents were refugees. They were understandably just working hard all the time. They didn't have any time to spend with me. So to get away from that, loneliness, you know, I went to the library and I borrowed a backpack full of books every week and brought it home and read them all by the next weekend. Right. And, you know, I could walk to the library or take the bus. I was given free range to do anything I wanted in the San Jose Public Library. And the wonderful thing about the library, the books are free. So I read all the, you know, things that you would expect to read from, you know, Curious George to Tintin. And then because there were no boundaries in the library, I could just go anywhere I wanted. So I went to the young adult section. I went to the adult section. I read things I should not have read. You know, some things I should have read. You know, I read All Quiet on the Western Front in the sixth grade. I read Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint when I was like 12 or 13, maybe too young to really.
Yes, I was going to say, and readers of The Sympathizer will catch that reference.
Oh boy. Like the only thing I remembered from Portnoy's Complaint, for those of you who have never read it, is when Alex Portnoy, this very hormonal adolescent, let's say, can't control himself. So he masturbates with everything, including a slab of liver from the family fridge that he masturbates into and then puts it back in the fridge for the family dinner later that night. And as a teenager or early teenager, I was like, what is going on here? And I never forgot this incredible moment in literature that I would then later put into The Sympathizer with a culturally appropriate item of food that, you know, because, you know, we wouldn't have a slab of liver in a Vietnamese village, we'd have something else. So that's, you have to read the book to know what this is. And honestly, you know, thank God for the public library. Thank God for the First Amendment that I also encountered all kinds of things I should not have read from very serious literature like Larry Heineman's Close Quarters, which deeply disturbed me. I've written about it, a novel about the Vietnam War that showed how brutal and ugly that war was, from the violence to the raping and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, scarred me as a kid. But then as a writer, you know, I realized, you know, that's what writers should do. You know, we shouldn't be pulling back. We should show things in all their brutal honesty, from masturbation to murder, you know. And I read things that I should not have read, like, you know, the public library for whatever reason had softcore pornography. I'm like, wow, this is
a full service organization.
Yeah, full time. This is before the age when you had the internet, so you could access it this way. This is the age when, if you're a horny adolescent, I don't know if you went through this experience, but you know, TVs, cable, if you didn't pay for it and you turned it on and you wanted to get the softcore porn channels, all you get was static and then an occasional image. So anyway, that was my mindset. And I know that half the audience is like, oh my God, this is disgusting. And, you know, but the thing is that as a writer, I think you have to be exposed to all these kinds of things. And the library provides that for better and for worse. Like, I would be terrified right now if my precocious son was going to the library and reading these things. He's 7 years old. In fact, he came into my office the other day. He likes to hang out here and bother me. He picked up the Committed right here and he opened it and he started reading it. And the first page that he falls onto is a page of like incredible brutal violence. And he's like, what's happening here? But I think that this is the power of literature that we can't contain. And, yeah. And to me, there's an analogy for parenting here that we can only do so much to protect our kids. Right. My parents could only do so much to protect me. And I entered the world that included the library and everything that it represented and everything that literature represents that I believe in, which is that literature allows us to experience the world in throughout the entire range of the beautiful to the ugly. And my own son will have to, you know, find his own way in that world too. And I will have to let him go and do that.
Yeah. I think it's hilarious when you talk about cable. I mean, I grew up, so I was born and raised in Morocco, and I grew up at a time when Morocco had one state television channel. So you were watching the official news and official programming, and that's it. So, you know, these are conditions under which, you know, it is not all too difficult to be a reader. But I think one of the things that really resonates with me with what you're saying is that although we grew up in very, very different circumstances, and you relied on the library, I relied on used bookstores and what my parents bought and all of that. I think the one thing that really strikes me as being something that we have in common is this complete freedom to read. You know, my parents never censored anything that I read. It was, you know, as long as I was reading, I was left alone and I enjoyed it. And so I just think that that's really what the first place where I felt free was in books. And then the other thing that also struck me is your mention of Tintin, which, you know, across all of our very different upbringings, yet we're still exposed to the same sort of like popular literature with its popular stereotypes and whatnot. Yeah.
It's one of my parenting challenges that, you know, I introduced my son to Tintin and he loves Tintin. So it still speaks like a century later, almost a century later to this kid, you know. And of course, there are problematic stereotypes in Tintin, whether we're talking about sort of like, you know, positive colonialism, where the Asians are being elevated in a certain way to like just like the out and out terrible way.
Tintin in the Congo and Tintin in the Land of Black Gold. Woo!
You know, and I find it very problematic to tell my to think that no, I can't expose my son to Tintin because of the problems. I think my attitude is more like, well, you know, I think we should have conversations about what we're seeing here.
Right.
Although you know, I do not have the Tintin in the Congo book in my house, and that's just like going way too far. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are other kinds of stereotypes that appear in Tintin that need to be addressed because they're still happening today. And I don't want to insulate my son from those kinds of things. In fact, I was preparing to teach my class today and it involves a clip from the movie from the TV show King of the Hill cartoon that features a Laotian character. It's a very funny clip where the Laotian character is explaining who he is to this table full of white guys. And they say, so are you Japanese or Chinese? And my son just laughed. He's like, this is racist, right? He's like, these guys are racist, right? He's 7 years old. So he's already, you know, aware of these kinds of things, which is a positive thing. But the last thing I'll say here is I learned from my son too. Like children's literature has changed a lot.
Yeah.
And I didn't know about any of this until he started I started reading what he's reading. Like, you know, like children's authors today, like in books like Dog Man and so on, which is a classic, you know, they do whatever they want. These writers and these illustrators, and they break all kinds of rules. And the kids likewise just go along for the ride because kids don't have any sense of, I mean, they're learning the rules, right? But they also don't have a sense of the rules at the same time. And I find that to be so liberating. And part of the inspiration for The Committed, some of the inspiration comes from children's literature. I mean, you can't tell from reading it, but when I was reading children's literature and seeing that these writers did whatever they wanted, I thought, well, why not?
Yeah.
Why, as an adult, do I feel like I have to follow this set of rules or this set of aesthetics or the what the critics are telling me to do or what the writing workshops are saying is an acceptable kind of aesthetic? And then you look at children's literature, that's so inspirational, like the anarchy that goes on in there. And so I'm still learning from the library and from literature.
That's great. And so then when did you make that leap from like being somebody who enjoys reading books, who goes to the library and borrows that backpack full of books? When did you make that leap from like being a reader to wanting to be a writer?
Well, in fact, also related to the library, when I was in the third grade, so when I was 7 or 8, my public school, you know, said, okay, all you kids go and we're going to do a project here and you can draw and write your own book and you can also do the cover and bind them as well. So I did that. I did a book called Lester the Cat, and it's, what are you laughing about? I think it's a great title.
Lester is such a good
title. Why Lester? Why a cat? I have no idea. I didn't have any pets. Okay. It's about an urban cat named Lester who's like, okay, so this tells you something about my mindset. He's stricken with ennui. He's bored of urban.
Already? Ennui? Your first
the classic narrative move, very archetypal. He flees the city to the country and finds love with a country cat. And I think it was heterosexual. I think that probably wouldn't go too far for me at that point. But so anyway.
So adventurous, but not too adventurous.
Yeah, exactly. the public library gives my book an award. I mean, there's an actual ceremony and all that kind of thing. And it's not like I'm the only one. There's like dozens of kids who get these awards, you know? So one of the poignant moments about this is my parents are so busy working, they don't have time to take me. Ceremony. So my school's librarian, bless her heart, I don't remember her name, I still see her face, you know, she came by, she drove down to my house, picked me up, took me to the San Jose Public Library, fed me lunch at this hotel across the street, which I thought was the fanciest thing in the world, and then allowed me to get my prize from the San Jose Public Library. So librarians, I owe you. And then this award from the public library set me on the road to 40 years of misery, because no one tells the kid what writing really involves. You know, no one tells him, okay, you're looking forward to a lifetime of drug addiction and alcoholism and tearing your heart out, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. No, give them a prize when they're 8 years old and then see what
lure them.
Yeah, so I love public libraries, and that's exactly what they're supposed to encourage, a love of literature and, you know, seducing innocent people into this business called writing. Well,
I swear we did not plan this whole, you know, this conversation about libraries and the importance of libraries, but I'm glad it turned out that way, and because everybody should be supporting their libraries. Okay, so we're going to be talking about The Committed. And this is a sequel to this other book, The Sympathizer, but I hasten to add for our audience that you don't need to have read The Sympathizer in order to enjoy The Committed. Viet will bring you up to speed very quickly on the main characters in the first part of the book. So The Committed is about two characters, the narrator, AKA the man of two faces, AKA the man of two minds, who's a half Vietnamese, half French spy, and the man whom he calls his childhood friend and blood brother, Bon. So together they've managed to survive a North Vietnamese re-education camp, a refugee camp, and they have landed in Paris, the City of Lights. And action takes place in the 1980s, which is an interesting time in France's history. François Mitterrand is president, as he will be between 1981 and I think like 1995. So it's long, you know, 15 years. The country is facing an economic crisis in the 80s. And not coincidentally, there are complaints about les immigrés, who as often as not are in fact citizens rather than immigrants. And it is into this environment that our two refugees arrive and immediately set about becoming Parisians, so to speak. So tell me about the joys of writing this book. What was fun about it for you? What kept you going during the writing?
Well, you know, it's a very momentous moment in French life, because this is the time when the French go from having 4 weeks of paid vacation to 5 weeks of paid vacation. You know, wow, such difficulty.
Suffering.
Suffering. I mean, the sixth week of paid vacation is going to take a little bit more time to get to that moment. I think it's fun because, you know, as I've said over and over again, I am a mentally colonized person. So I just admit it. You know, I come from Vietnam. My parents actually were born under French colonization. My 86-year-old father still sings songs that he remembers from his French education.
Wow.
And I go, you know, weak in the knees when I hear French or when someone, anything related to France. And so I wanted to sort of be able to interrogate my own mental colonization. But I wanted to write a novel that would pull the plug on the City of Light, because this is not a novel that is, you know, the tourist version of Paris, you know, Eiffel Tower, the Seine, all that kind of stuff. Right. This is a novel that's set in the immigrant quarters of Paris, as you said, and quote unquote the grittier part of Paris, but also I think a really, really interesting parts of Paris. It's the parts that I like to hang out in when I go there. And you know, when the narrator steps off the airplane at Charles de Gaulle Airport in 1982, he says, "Hey, this airport is named after Charles de Gaulle, one of the greatest of great Frenchmen in recent memory, the man who liberated the French from the Nazis, even as he continued to enslave us Vietnamese." And he says, this is a contradiction, right? And contradiction is the perpetual body odor of humanity. So that's the mood of the novel, that it wants to, you know, interrogate these hypocrisies and these absurdities, which are part of French culture, but really are part of every culture. The Americans got their turn in the sympathizer, you know. And after that, I said, who else can I offend? Obviously the French, because my narrator is part French and part Vietnamese. And so he's going to pursue this, you know, this satire and so on. But of course, underneath the satire and the humor, hopefully if you find it funny, there's also some tragedy that is taking place, because, you know, the novel is investigating French colonization and its aftermath. A lot of terrible things happened. And the French, what I was thinking about was, look, when in the sympathizer, you know, everybody knows about the Vietnam War because the Americans recorded it all in full color, whether we're talking about the news journalists or whether we're talking about Hollywood in the years after the war. Right. So ironically, the Americans recorded their own atrocities. And so we have this sense that we think we know something about the Vietnam War. Now, French colonization, all we have are you know, these black and white photographs with the French people in white linen suits and their Vietnamese servants. And so maybe we come away with that with a sort of this romantic idea of French colonization. And the French, so the French got away with it, because now you can go dine at restaurants called Le Colonial and pretend that you're on a rubber plantation, and how wonderful that must be, eating Vietnamese food on a French rubber plantation, when in fact the Vietnamese who rebelled against the French said, we're slaves. I mean, that's the term that they use. This is enslavement. And that's why we're revolting against the French. Mm-hmm. So that's what The Committed is really, you know, dealing with. I mean, the present is set in this crime and gangsters narrative in 1982 Paris, but the backdrop is this history of French colonization of Indochina that the French have pretty much, I think, totally forgotten about.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's interesting. I hadn't thought about this idea of the documentation of war and colonialism as it is happening, and the comparison between the Vietnamese experience, say, and something like the Algerian experience. Because when did the French arrive in Vietnam? In the late 19th century, right?
Mid 19th century, they fully successfully colonized by 1887, I think.
Yeah, and then they left though before the, I think, was it 1954? I want to say
54. Yeah.
I mean, oh, good. I remember.
Right on time, right? So, pass the quiz.
No, I taught the quiet American, so I know. That's interesting. So, because in Algeria, it would, you know, there's that whole period of time between, say, 1954 and 1962, when there's plenty of photography and there's moving pictures and there's a lot of documentation. And that's what enables a film like The Battle of Algiers to be made in, you know, not long after that war to be made and produced. But you don't, you know, it's interesting to me that they have this very different memory of what their presence in Vietnam was like. I hadn't thought about that, about like the difference in documentation. Now, what about sort of the challenges of writing this book, which is set in a country that you've only visited as a tourist? What are some of the challenges that you encounter as you wrote it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the major difference, one of the major differences is that in writing The Sympathizer as an American, I think I completely understand, you know, what's going through American minds and what that war was about. Here in the French context, you know, I'm an outsider to it. And so the way that I constructed the novel was to reflect that, you know, and I positioned my sympathizer in this novel as someone who has been educated in the French system in Vietnam, but he's never been to France. He hasn't spoken French in 15 or 20 years. And so he's an outsider. So if there are any mistakes that happen in this book, it's not my fault. It's his fault, because he's in the world as an immigrant, all right? So that was one way to get around this kind of issue. And the other way of getting around this issue is that, you know, hopefully there's enough details in the novel to evoke Paris for readers. And then we feel, you know, I think many people have some image of Paris and they just fill in the blanks. but I deliberately made it sort of, there's a slight layer of gauze over the depiction of the city, because I'm not constantly saying they're on this street, they're on that street, it's this cafe or that cafe. There's a very sparing use of that. So it's a little bit different level of detail in this novel versus the other. And then the other issue was the very different world that we have here in Paris and in France versus what we have in the United States. I'll bring up one, you know, example, and you already sort of alluded to that with the Algerian War, that the Vietnamese in Paris are a very small population. I've been to Paris before, but for this novel, I went a couple of times, talked to as many French people of Vietnamese descent as I could. And one of the things they brought up, you know, compared to Vietnamese Americans, is there aren't that many of us here. So it's harder for us to do the Vietnamese American thing here. Plus there's all this French pressure to assimilate and just be completely French and all of that. And so that's a very different experience there. And he's moving in the world of the French of Vietnamese descent. And then he encounters, you know, because he becomes a drug dealer, he makes these very smart choices, becomes a drug dealer, and his gang get into conflict with a rival gang of Algerian drug dealers. And so that was challenging, because that dynamic is it's not completely different, but it is different in some ways than what I'm used to in the United States. I had to worry about whether I was going to do a disservice to the French of Algerian descent by depicting them as gangsters. So I had to worry about these kinds of issues. So but I felt like I had to do it, because one of the things that I wanted to talk about in this novel, and I think that has some relevance to what we're dealing with in the United States, is that I wanted to show how, as an outcome of colonization, people don't become better people necessarily, you know? And so just because there are Vietnamese people and Algerian people in Paris who have been colonized by the French doesn't mean that they're going to become friends and yeah. allies. You know, and in fact, that's what the issue of the gang war is about. It's like, hey, oftentimes people who've been colonized turn against each other. Yeah. And I think that has a lot of resonance with what we're experiencing in the United States today, right. That colonialism divides and conquers. Well, racism divides and conquers here in the United States as well.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, they're fighting over their territory. They're fighting over survival. And so in the narrator, which I think I mentioned, is a communist spy whose cover was never blown. And his friend Bon has lost his loved ones to communists. So he hates communists. And so the narrator has to keep pretending that he shares these feelings, and so that, you know, his cover is maintained. So in this book, as in all of your fiction, there's just a deep preoccupation with belonging and betrayal, whether it is to or of a nation, a community, a family. And I'm just wondering, do you think that belonging can ever be settled?
Well, that's a hard one. okay, so I would like to say no, never. But I'm speaking to you, and here's my little bit of personal history, right? In my entire life, I felt unsettled. I felt like always out of place.
Yeah.
Ever since I was growing up. When I was little, in my parents' Vietnamese household, I felt like an American spying on them. And then when I stepped out, I felt like I was a Vietnamese person spying on Americans. And that sense of being ill at ease has filtered into every aspect of my life. You know, among writers, I feel like I'm out of place because I'm a scholar. Among scholars, I feel out of place because I'm a writer, and so on. And this unease is actually very productive for being a writer. That sense of friction, that sense of being able to look at any issue from both sides, which is what I taught, you know, why I created my character in this way, is really productive. So what I'm saying is I fetishize being out of place. And then 2 years ago, I moved to Pasadena. So
that sounds like a confession the way you say it.
Yeah. In 2005, I thought about moving to Pasadena. I'd been living in Silver Lake, and I went to Pasadena, and I looked around. I was like, this city is so nice. It's so quiet. It's so boring. I can't be here. I got to go back to exciting Silver Lake. So anyway, now I'm a father. 2 years ago, went out to Pasadena again. I'm like, hey, I like it here. It's nice and quiet and boring, which is exactly what I want. So now I'm boring, and I feel at home finally with my family in Pasadena. This is very weird for me. All right. apologies to all the Pasadena people listening. This is meant to be a compliment. But so now, to answer your question, I theoretically, I would say belonging never gets settled. And yet here it is. I'm saying to you, I feel at home. But that is against my personal circumstance, is set against this larger social circumstance that we're in of anti-Asian violence.
Right.
I swear to God, I go out my front door to get my garbage or whatever, bring my garbage can in, car drives by in my very nice, quiet neighborhood, and my hackles go up. I'm thinking, what if this person rolls down the window and says something to me? I mean, my wife says that she got flashed the white power sign down the street from our house.
Goodness.
You know, so it's like even the personal sense of belonging that I have achieved, I'm aware it's very personal. It's not a commentary about all of society and what we're going through. Right. So to answer your question, can belonging ever be achieved? No, it cannot be, you know, because the social and political and economic contradictions that lead people to feeling out of place mm-hmm. are deeply and structurally embedded in our society. We're not solving this problem, people, mm-hmm. by eating Korean tacos, okay? It's not a cultural and culinary issue where if we think, oh, if we just mix all our food together and we all enjoy each other's food, then somehow we can solve the East-West problem or whatever. No, it's not. Those are just manifestations of these deeper contradictions that are tied to slavery and colonization and genocide and anti-Black racism mm-hmm. and the ongoing colonizations of Native peoples and all this kind of stuff into which we as Asian Americans, are inserted. And so anti-Asian violence and this sense of our sense of belonging being ruptured is cyclical. We, you know, I don't know how many Asian Americans have felt at home for the last two or three decades, but it's an illusion because that anti-Asian violence has always been there waiting to be reawakened. And even if we solve this issue, this spate of assault that we're going through right now, we'd be delusional if we thought that somehow it would not happen again in the future under the right circumstances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, since we're talking about Asian violence, I wanted to ask you, you're frequently asked to comment about issues like this, whether it is anti-Asian violence, whether it is the Vietnam War, how it's represented in media and film, issues of race. Do you feel, how do you fit that part of writing, like this sort of public commentary with the rest? How do you see that with the rest of your writing? Does it feel like an opportunity? Does it feel like an imposition? Does it feel, you know, how do you feel about it?
Well, the title, The Committed, one of the things that it refers to several things, but one thing it refers to is the idea of the committed writer. And as we discover in the novel, right? You know, he's writing his confession. All right. But, you know, ever since I wanted to be a writer, not that moment when I was 8 years old doing Lester the Cat, you know, but when I went to college and I thought, oh, maybe I should think about this seriously. You know, my ideal writer was always the committed writer. The writers that I looked up to, like people, I don't know, like Edward Said or James Baldwin or Toni Morrison or Frantz Fanon, who appears in this novel, this idea that the writer is engaged, both at the level of the art. So I'm committed to the art, but also committed to the political and social issues from which the art can't be extricated. The world and the text, as Edward Said said, are completely entwined with each other. And so in college, I was already writing op-eds. I was already a very opinionated person in college. And in college, some of my earliest op-eds were about the Miss Saigon controversy of 1991 and affirmative action. Lo and behold, I mean, you fast forward nearly 30 years later, I wrote the exact same op-eds for the New York Times about the revival of Miss Saigon and the ongoing controversies over affirmative action in the place of Asian Americans in affirmative action. So I feel like it is in a way drawing me away from writing fiction on the one hand, in terms of time. On the other hand, I see it all as a continuum, like the social and political issues that I engage with non-fictionally in these op-eds and so on are completely connected to the world of the fiction as well. And thinking through some of these issues in our everyday life affects the fiction and vice versa. And that's how I can make this, I think, this connection
right.
between the violence that goes on in Paris between Algerians and Vietnamese and the violence that's happening in the United States today that affects Asians. And that sometimes it's happening, sometimes from white people, but sometimes from other people of color as
right.
well.
Right, right. it's interesting to hear you talk about this, these writers like Baldwin and Morrison and Fanon and others, because it occurs to me that in places like Morocco, where I grew up, or France, since we've talked so much about France, there is no apparent contradiction between being a writer of fiction and commenting, as you do, on issues of race or what's going on in sort of the public sphere. It's only, it strikes me, it's only in the US where there's like, where writers are supposed to stay in their lanes and write fiction and have nothing to say about anything else. And if they do, it seems almost as if people were being rude for for getting out of our lane. Do you get that sense too? Like, do you get like these, like people think that like, I sometimes get emails about like being angry, and I'm like, yes, I'm angry. Of course. Of course, there's a lot to be angry about. So do you notice that difference? Or is it, I mean, in cultures between, say, for example, a place like France and a place like the US with respect to the place of the writer?
Yeah, I mean, so, I mean, like, well, part of the fascination with French culture for me, and part of the stereotyping of French culture, is that, hey, this is a land that values its intellectuals and its writers. The French love to say this kind of thing. And we see a tradition of people like Sartre and Camus and so on and so forth being politically engaged and lionized, both for the art, but also for the politics. And, you know, and the reason I think, you know, in the United States, I think you're right, we don't have as much of a tradition of that. And, you know, I think that there's certain historical reasons. We are a deeply anti-communist country. Arguably, we're kind of an anti-intellectual country as well. So writers on the one hand are discouraged from taking on politically left-wing positions. And then we're discouraged from being too highfalutin in our ideas. So I'll give you an example. Okay. So The Committed, there's been quite a bit of commentary in reviews. I mean, I'm trying not to read the reviews, but the few that have slipped past me, some of them have said, hey, there's a lot of philosophy in this book. I'm like, a lot of philosophy? It's not like I'm making people read philosophy in the book, people. Like, I drop a few names, and then like I'll summarize the ideas so that you can understand what is being said. You don't actually have to read the philosophy, all right? But simply by introducing these philosophical ideas, a handful of them, some American readers are like, we don't know what to do with this. This doesn't happen in fiction, apparently. And they remark upon it. And I'm just so annoyed by that, which I think is anti-intellectual. It's a very narrow definition of literature that says, you know, literature should only be middle-brow realism. And if you introduce ideas, don't make it so obvious, because readers just don't know how to deal with it. So yeah, I think, you know, I have a beef with a lot of contemporary American literature and some of the responses to it on the part of reviewers and teachers as well. And, you know, we can do so much more in terms of both politics and ideas in our literature. And that's partly what The Committed does. I mean, The Committed is a crime thriller. There's a lot of violence, a lot of drugs, lots of sex, all that kind of good stuff.
And it's funny.
Thank you. And it's a thriller of ideas, because I'm thrilled by ideas. So I'm shocked when people are not thrilled by ideas.
All right. We're running out of time. There was something I was going to ask you that I thought wouldn't take too long. Let me just see if I can remember it now. All right, it'll come back to me later. I do see that we are starting to get questions in the Q&A. So I'm going to read you, this is a reader question or a viewer question. Can you talk about your relationship with this character from the two books, I think is what they mean. What compelled you to follow him through two novels?
Well, honestly, he's kind of my alter ego. So, you know, I think that I created him as someone, a man of two faces and two minds. And it's really an exaggeration of my own perspective. Like I said earlier, I felt like a spy growing up in my parents' house and so on. And I always saw the world from two sides, from two perspectives. I could never stop myself from always thinking, well, what about what the other side thinks about this kind of an issue? It's not a comfortable position to be in, because I think most people want to see an issue from one side, and they want you to be on their side. So if you come along and say, well, what about the other side? They can get kind of irritated with you. But it's a very good perspective for fiction and for criticism to have this kind of flexibility of perspective. And so I found my character to be really interesting, you know, and he took on a life of his own after I created him in The Sympathizer. You know, for example, before The Sympathizer, nobody would have said, hey, Viet's a funny guy. No, never.
I would.
I'm not sure you knew me before The Sympathizer, but anyway, but I created a character who could be funny. You know, he had a certain worldview. I put him in certain situations, and all of a sudden this dude started saying funny things. And I realized that's been inside of me this entire time, but I've tamped it down, you know, because you cannot be funny as a professor in the academy and hope to survive. Your fellow professors, they don't have a sense of humor. All right. And so all that stuff has been contained, and the creation of The Sympathizer allowed me to let it all out. So, you know, it just felt right to continue his story, not just for crassly commercial exploitative purposes, but because there are real aesthetic and political reasons to continue his story in the sequel. Because in the committed, one of the things I wanted to talk about was, you know, what does a revolutionary do who still wants to pursue a revolution after his own revolution has failed him? So communism failed him in The Sympathizer, but he hasn't given up on this dream that he has, that the world can be a better place, that revolution can play some kind of purpose in it. And so what exactly does that revolution look like? He tries to give you an answer by the end of the book.
All right. Another question is, I get the arc from The Sympathizer through to the committee, through to the committed. This must be at least a trilogy or perhaps a tetralogy. Where are you headed?
Well, very perceptive question. You know, I hope when you hit the last page of the committee, you feel like, oh, this is an end to the novel. It feels like this is the right place to end, but also that it's an opening. You know, I can't give anything away, but it feels to me that it's obvious something else has to happen after this last page. And yeah, it sets us up for the third part of the trilogy. No more. You know, I think when you do series, you have to know when to end. And I think it's a natural end. But he returns to Southern California in part three of the Sympathizer trilogy in the mid to late 1980s. And this is, I think, a rich time. You know, this is my time when I was an adolescent, mid to late 1980s. Think about it. This is Ronald Reagan. This is Star Wars, both the movie, but also the SDI. Missile SDI, you know, Iran-Contra. This is, when we're talking about LA, arguably the CIA importing crack cocaine into the Black community. You know, it may be a conspiracy theory. It may have been real, but I'm going to run with it. Because it's going to allow me to continue one of the narratives from the committed, which is that drug running is a state enterprise. You know, all the hysteria is about the individual drug dealer or whatever, the person who's going to mug you on the street or something like that, when really the real threat is the state and corporations running drugs. We look at Indochina, one of the things that the novel brings up, the French financed their empire in Indochina by producing opium and forcing the Indochinese to buy the opium. The British did the same thing in their own empire. The French and the British were the original drug runners. And then if we look at today, who are the biggest drug dealers in the United States? The Sackler family. These nice, I'm sure, very nice, well-behaved white people. These people are making billions off of killing Americans with opioids. Mm-hmm. Those are the real drug dealers. Anyway, so there's my little rant. And so in the committed... the third part of the Sympathizer trilogy will deal with all that kind of stuff, and plus 80s music as well.
That's good. All right, I'm looking forward to that. The next question is, you have just announced that the Sympathizer and the Committed will be adapted into a TV show by A24. Which actor do you want to play the main character? And also, what are the qualities that the lead character should embody? I wonder if this is coming from a...
I did suggest myself, but down as a possibility. Anyway, I'm hoping for a minor role as someone who gets killed in the book, but we'll see. You know, it's an option. So those of you who are familiar with Hollywood know there's a long road before anything can get actually done. But, you know, we did, as part of the option, get Park Chan-wook to sign a contract as well. And Park Chan-wook... you all should know his work. If you've seen Old Boy, for example, Old Boy is an incredible movie, big influence on The Sympathizer. So when Park Chan-wook expressed interest in this book, I was like, God, yes, you are the perfect person to adapt this, because he has the visual flair and the quirky imagination.
Right.
And, you know, he came and we talked a couple of times, and I swear to God, he's one of the best interlocutors I've ever had on this novel, like from a story point of view. Like, he's saying, why didn't you do this? And I would have done this. And I was like, you're right. Why didn't you read this manuscript before I published it? Something into the novel. So we might see changes in the story because of him. But you know, he's a fantastic visual director. I think it's a sense of the politics that are concerned. And so in terms of who's going to be the lead actor, well, I think that's going to be the big mystery. I think I can populate many of the roles in the book with actors, but the lead actor is a mystery to me. And I think they're going to do a big search for a person who can fit.
Yeah. And he directed also The Handmaiden, right?
Incredible movie.
It's an incredible, incredible, incredible movie. Yeah. I'm so excited. Yeah.
He did The Little Drummer Girl, the adaptation of the John le Carré novel a couple of years ago, which is actually a very good TV adaptation too.
Oh, that's great. All right. So the next one is, my roommate's daughter is Japanese American and her husband is Vietnamese American. What children's books would you recommend that I buy for the young children? Oh, I have a feeling you're going to have a good recommendation for this one.
Oh, I can't be so crassly. So
oh, yes, you
have to recommend The Chicken of the Sea. No. Well, anyway, my son, Allison, he came up with Chicken of the Sea at 5 years old. And yes, I exploited him. Yes, we sold the book to McSweeney's. And yes, you can buy it. It's about boar chickens who run away from the farm. An echo of Lester the Cat running away from Ennui. But, you know, I think that I can't think of an exact perfect combination in case you're thinking of Japanese and Vietnamese combinations. But I think that Bao Phi is a terrific children's book writer. He went from being, you know, a slam poet who you might want to like shield your kids from, to writing these really moving children's books from A Different Pond, which is about the, you know, the Vietnamese refugee experience, to, you know, the next book whose title I can't recall, but it's about, you know, a daughter with two mothers, you know. So I love Bao Phi. I love the work that he's doing. In terms of other children's literature that's Asian American, You know what you should do though? You should go to Instagram and follow My Story, M-A-Y Story. She's a friend of the family, and she's a bookstagrammer. I never knew about this until I joined Instagram, but people who just do books and she specializes in children's books, and she herself is Vietnamese American. There are a lot of great book recommendations on My Story. I'll look up her Instagram thing and I'll put it in the chat in just a moment.
Yeah, it's My M-A-Y Story. All right. Here's another question. I assume part of French colonization was the invention of the modern Vietnamese alphabet, which I assume replaced writing Vietnamese using Chinese characters. Do you have thoughts on the consequences of this for the language or the culture?
I think the Portuguese actually came up with it first, Alexander de Rhodes, as it was a Portuguese missionary, if I remember my Vietnamese history correctly, but the French certainly took it, this Romanized alphabet, and instituted it as part of their educational system. And, you know, it's a mixed bag, right? Because if we look at Indochina, which is Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, the French came in and they took these three countries, they chopped up Vietnam into three parts, and they put it all together as Indochina. They turned the Vietnamese into their collaborators, or maybe the Vietnamese were willing to be turned into their collaborators as well. And so the Vietnamese became part of the French bureaucracy. You know, they helped run the French bureaucracy in these colonies. And I think part of the way that happened was because they learned French, but also because there was this whole system of the Romanized alphabet that was brought in as part of the French colonial educational system. So what can I say? I don't know. I mean, all I know is being colonized. It's the same dilemma that other colonized populations have confronted. Do I have a choice but to write in English, for example? Or would I have a choice if I wrote in Vietnamese but to write in the Romanized alphabetical system? Yes, theoretically, I could go and I could learn Chữ Nôm, the Neo-Chinese script that was there between Chinese rule and French rule. But who's going to read it? Who's going to read it, you know? And so the Vietnamese had to write in this Romanized alphabetical system. That's where Vietnamese literature is today. Mm-hmm. So, and as for me, you know, to take that question to next step, I have to write in English. I could try to write in Vietnamese, but number one, it'd be really hard. And number two, when we look at the way the world works, one of the reasons why we read French literature and English language literature is not because French writers are just better than everybody else, or that English language writers are just better than everybody else. We read them because of imperialism, that you have to read French literature, you have to read American literature, you have to read English literature, because these people colonized the world. And so if I wrote in Vietnamese, how many people would actually read what I wrote? Very few, outside of Vietnam. But if I write in English, my books are translated into, I don't know, close to 30 languages. And that's not a function just because of my writing. It's a function of writing in English and as a part of an American publishing industry that has global reach. That's one of the ironic, tragic consequences of colonization that, you know, I'm stuck with, and that I have that helps to define me. That makes me into, as I try to say in the committed, a kind of a Caliban. Like, I have no choice, mm-hmm. I think, but to curse you in your own language with a click as well.
All right, so here's another question. Thank you for your emphasis on the First Amendment. How do you feel about demands for limitations on speech on social media?
Demands for limitations on speech on social media. Well, I think there's a difference between official censorship, that is censorship carried out with the power of the state, and the kind of what I think the questioner is asking about, which is what we call cancellation, right? Like social media forms of discouragement of speech, which doesn't, you know, I mean, it's very powerful, because it is, if you've been subjected to a social media attack, it's really kind of dispiriting. So there's a real power to it that I don't want to discount, but it's also different than official state censorship. And so I can't help but, yes, people are upset, you know, and they're using the power that they have, in this case, social media, to try to do things that have been denied to them through other channels. So you can disagree or you can agree or disagree with the specific manifestations of this, but I think the reason why people have taken to social media to cancel is because they don't see people being actually punished in real life for the things that they have done. So if men, for example, are not getting fired for sexual harassment and rape and all these kinds of things, then take to social media and punish them there. And then maybe that would actually lead to real firings, which is what's taken place. So I think we have to contextualize it in that fashion and say, yes, people can go overboard. Yes, people can be victimized the wrong way through social media cancellation, but put this into the larger context of why people are doing this and whether or not our society as a whole has held people accountable for the very real transgressions that have been going on for a very long time. And then finally, the official censorship thing, just remember that under the previous administration, in which, you know, Republicans have been calling up this attack against cancellation and arguing that cancellation is a left-wing thing, it was under the previous administration that the previous administration would actually set out to censor actual things. Like, the Trump administration passed an executive amendment in the last few months of the administration saying that no federal agency and nobody funded by the federal government, which is a lot of institutions, can engage in diversity, equity, and inclusion education and can say things like white supremacy. I mean, that's censorship with the full force of the federal government and billions of dollars threatened to be pulled, you know, from that kind of a gesture. So we need to put all that into perspective.
All right. So I think this might be our last question because we're running out of time. Oh dear, I've got several questions to pick from, but here's one about the novel. The dualities in both novels are amazing, but there is one character, Claude, who seems more singular. Am I reading this incorrectly?
Well, Claude, if you remember from The Sympathizer, is a CIA agent and the mentor of our sympathizer. And he is a part of the Central Intelligence Agency. I just want to show you one thing here very, very quickly. And that is the cover of the UK edition,
right,
which has a cigarette lighter, a Zippo lighter, that our agent Claude has given to our sympathizer, imprinted right, with the motto of the Central Intelligence Agency, fuck them before they fuck us. Now, I don't know if that's the real motto of the CIA, but it should be. and the UK publisher is brave enough to put that on the cover of their book. So Claude does seem to be the expression of a Central Intelligence Agency united in its mission. But trust me, in the third and final installment, we will see a different side of Claude.
Okay, brilliant. All right, my dear, this was really lovely talking to you. I always have so much fun during our conversation. Thank you all so much for tuning in. And please, please, please support the author by ordering his book from your independent bookstore. I like the UK edition. Both of them are great. This is a great cover, so you can see the Man of Two Faces.
I'm so inspired that I ordered my own lighters.
Are you even a smoker? Are you
no, here? But I just want to flash this sometimes, you know, and if you're a lucky person, I might give it to you.
Oh, I am a lucky person. I was born under a very lucky All right. Okay. Thank you all so
thank
much.
Thank you so much, Layla.
Thank you. Bye, you guys. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Riet and Layla, what can I say? Thank you so much for being with us. I have to say, we've had so many events, but this has to be one of the most fun events we've ever had. You've covered, both of you, so many issues, current issues, historical issues. I'm sure everyone who's been here today is going to always remember this event for a long, long time. I do encourage all of you who are here today as part of this event to please go and purchase The Committed and The Other Americans. They're available at the library store or I'm sure at your local independent bookstore. And all of you remember to register for the May 20th event. We're going to have Daniel James Brown come to talk about his new book. His other book, the previous book, won an award, Boys in the Boat. And this new book is called Facing the Mountain. It's a story about Japanese American heroes in World War II. And so please register for the event. And until next time, stay safe, stay connected, and keep reading. Goodbye.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.